Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. This is a weekly program, as I hope most of you already know, devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives. Jobs, incomes, debts, money that our kids have to save up and we have to save up so they can get a proper education. And we'll have a lot to say about education later today. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all of my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. Let's get right down to it, even though I have some housekeeping to do a little bit later, because we have so much to go over, it's kind of bewildering for me where to start. But let's start with people concerned about public education, and concerned that in the aftermath of the economic crisis, rather than taxing the big corporations that brought us the crisis, rather than taxing the rich who have become so much richer over the last 30 to 40 years, the solution, and I put that in quotation marks, to our economic crisis brought to us by those folks has been to let them off scot-free and to focus instead on savaging the public services delivered to the mass of people who not only did not participate in bringing on this crisis, but have been the major victims of it so far. But there is good news in a way that people are beginning to fight back. I may even call this program Rising Up Against Austerity. Let's start with Seattle. I want to take my hat off to the thousands and thousands of students and teachers who went off the job last Tuesday, in order to make a statement. They don't want schools cut. They don't want teacher salaries destroyed. They don't want larger class size. They don't want to compromise the education of their children simply to let off corporations and the rich from the taxes they could pay and the taxes they should pay to solve the problems they, more than anyone else, produced for this economy. And at the same time, I want to take my hat off to the tens of thousands of people across Puerto Rico facing the desperate end of this crisis, and by end I mean the worst conditions in it. You know, Puerto Rico is being treated by this crisis in the United States economy just the way Greece has been treated by this crisis in the European economy. That is, the place where the worst is done, where the greatest cutbacks are imposed on people, where the greatest suffering is imposed on people who by no stretch of anyone's demented imagination could be held responsible for the crisis. No, they are the victims of the crisis, and now they're being victimized by the quote-unquote policies being undertaken to cope with the damage done by the crisis. But thousands of people in Puerto Rico and thousands of people literally diametrically at the opposite end of the United States, Seattle, Washington, are taking to the streets to express their anger about austerity. It's the wrong policy, it is the unjust policy, and it basically rewards those who brought the crisis while victimizing further those who have already suffered from it. And not to leave out Europe, of course. There's interesting news in Europe, not this time about Greece, but about another country that looks to be going down Greece's path, Portugal. This week, Antonio Costa, the head of the Portuguese Socialist Party, now ahead in the polls for the election to be held in October in Portugal, has announced that his party and the government he hopes to be elected to run will replicate what Syriza has done in Greece. That is, no more cutbacks, no more savaging the services provided to people, none of that. That is over. We're going to take care of people first and protect corporations and the rich later, if at all. That's a radical shift, And it is signs that what Syriza had the courage to do so far in Greece is being picked up by others. And it's a warning to Germany and France and the other wealthier parts of Europe that in the end, if you try to shift the cost of a crisis you help bring onto the backs of those least able to support it, you are risking social disaster. Next update. Hats off again, this time to the City Council of Los Angeles, California, to the decision they made this last week to commit that city to minimum wage of $15 an hour to be implemented by the year 2020. Los Angeles therefore joins several other cities, both in and out of California, that have moved in that direction in a similar way. Long overdue to make those at the bottom participate at least in a modest way, and let me underscore, it's modest. Participate in a modest way in the wealth generated by their labor and by everyone else in this society. I want to turn next to an update that strikes me as particularly important. The head of Continental Resources, a major oil and gas company, is named Harold Hamm, H-A-M-M. And in a story on the 15th of May in the Bloomberg News Service, a story is laid out complete with photocopies of the relevant emails showing that Harold Hamm put extraordinary pressure on the University of Oklahoma, and in particular on the Oklahoma Geological Survey that is housed as part of the University of Oklahoma. What Mr. Hamm was after, and the emails leave no doubt whatsoever, as anyone interested can check by looking at the story by the author of the piece is Elgin, E-L-G-I-N, Bloomberg, May 15th. What Mr. Hamm was doing was trying to get the university either to close down the Oklahoma Geological Survey or else to allow him to veto or control what professors stay there, what professors get hired, and what was the issue. Why was Mr. Hamm, whose expertise, if he has any, is in the business of oil and gas, and certainly not in running universities or deciding on professors of geology, why was he meddling in this way, undermining academic freedom, undermining what a university is supposed to do? Well, the answer is crystal clear. It turns out that Oklahoma has been having a growing number of earthquakes. That's right, earthquakes. And they didn't have them before, nothing like this. And the earthquakes began to be traced by geologists, whose expertise this is, were traced to the injection of water and salt water and so on, basically the process of fracking, driving up oil and gas by means of pumping fluids down deep under the ground. Scientists and others have been warning that fracking has all kinds of ecological damage. One of the kinds of damage is provoking earthquakes. And the scientific researchers in Oklahoma discovered clear links between the explosion of earthquakes and the explosion of fracking, the search for oil and bringing up cheap oil, which it turns out Harold Hamm's Continental Resources has been busy doing. How did he react to this scientific finding of endangerment of the community? He reacted the way capitalists most of the time react. He wanted to silence the criticism so the profitable business of oil and gas could roll ahead. He wanted to sacrifice health, well-being, life itself, of other people, of course, to the profitability of his enterprise. It looks as though, for the moment, the university has resisted. But clearly there was ambiguity among the leaders of the university. The emails show that as well. This is a tip of an iceberg. Enterprises, as they become major donors of universities, are not shy of using their influence to shape the faculty, to shape the curriculum, to shape the very existence of scientific inquiry, if and when it suits them. The story of Harold Hamm of Continental Resources and the University of Oklahoma should make everyone wonder about how we arrange the relationship between business and academic life and the risks of that organization to subordinating learning to the profits of a few. Around the United States, my next update, there is an attack on trade unions going on. One of them in California is particularly interesting. It makes the argument that union members, being part of an organization, have to vote about what candidates they will contribute money to, or to rather be more exact, they vote about what candidate their union will contribute money to. Most unions contribute most of their support to the Democratic Party. That's been true for decades. Okay, that has made the Republican Party interested in defeating the Democrats by cutting off union funding, which is one of the most important sources of funding for the Democratic Party. The Republican Party gets the lion's share of business support and support from the rich. That leaves the Democratic Party with really very little in the way of support from those groups relative to the Republicans. So the Democrats rely more on the unions. So it's not so surprising that the Republicans are after depriving the Democratic Party of union support. But of course, nothing can be spoken so bluntly. That's one of the reasons I'm blunt, in order to make clear what's going on through the fudge and phoniness of the words that are used. So the battle the Republicans are waging is, you'll enjoy this, for the rights of free speech of workers. That's right. The Republican Party wants you to believe that they're spending a lot of money and time and energy because they want working people to have free speech. Wow. And what does the free speech mean? Workers should not be required to pay dues to an organization that ends up spending a portion of those dues for a political party those workers don't want to support. Now, this is cute. You're a member of an organization that works democratically. You vote for what you prefer. Other workers in the union vote for what they prefer. The majority prefers to support the Democratic Party rather than the Republican for reasons which nobody who pays attention will have much trouble understanding. Now the minority, not happy with the outcome of the vote, wants to not be required to support it. This reminds me of old arguments about people who didn't like what the government did with their taxes, deciding that therefore they shouldn't have to pay taxes. Well, if you want there to be a union that protects you, and you want it to run democratically, you kind of have to be willing to take a loss for your side if the majority is supposed to win. But, you know, this really isn't about democracy in the union. The Republicans have always been very clear they don't want unions, democratic or otherwise. And here the reality is simple. If you can get union dues not to be used for political purposes, you're depriving the Democratic Party of a major source of its revenue, and you're guaranteeing that the kinds of support union backed candidates usually provide for taxes on the rich, at least a little, for spending money on people's needs, at least a little, for the things that most people want, at least a little, well, then you need the unions to be able to raise money for the Democratic Party, because if they can't, the advantages to the Republicans with their base in wealth and privilege and power will be unbeatable at the polls, won't it? That's the issue. And when you hear about free speech for working people and the Republicans are behind it, you now know, as much as you need to, I think, what the reality is that's going on. Okay, I want to turn now, as we do at this point in the program often, to the questions and comments you send in and my response to them. Before I start, I want to remind everyone, please make use of our two websites that I'm going to give you in a moment to send us your comments, your questions, your ideas. We read every one. We can only answer a few because we get too many, for which we are grateful. But we read them all and use them to shape what we do on this program, how we proceed, how we treat materials, and so on. Here's the first one. rdwolf.com. rdwolf.com. And the other one, Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info. Not only will those websites accept your comments and criticisms and let you convey them to us, but there's other things those websites do for you, 24/7 at absolutely no charge. They provide you with lots of material beyond what we do on this program. They're important for that. They allow you also to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Very simple to do that. They allow you to sign up for our newsletter, which we urge you to do. And they allow you as well to relate to use material that we invite you to share. Become a partner with us in getting this kind of economic analysis out to all the people that might be interested. First question. Is there any real evidence that political scientists have discovered that would support the idea that the government is run by business way more than by anybody else in the population? Now, this is something that I kind of support, if you think about it, fairly often on this program. So it's a good question, put it right to me, to see if I can find for you the kinds of careful scientific research to support what I suspect many of you believe, what I know I believe, with the kind of empirical research one hopes to find. Well, the answer is yes. And I want to tell you exactly what the findings were, where they are, who produced them, who these people are, so you have a sense of the scientific background for the assertion that business is what shapes our government. Okay, the research, and I'm going to give you the full title, the research appeared in a journal called Perspectives on Politics. That is a journal produced by the American Political Science Association, the basic academic research association for political scientists across the United States. In the issue of this journal, Perspectives on Politics, Volume 12, Issue Number 3, dated September 2014, so just a few months ago, an article appeared called Testing Theories of American Politics. In other words, they're testing, among other theories, the theory I just articulated, namely that business runs the governmental show. There were two authors, and I'm going to go through this slowly because I want any one of you interested in pursuing this to read the article and to appreciate the research. First author, Martin Gillens, G-I-L-E-N-S. He's a professor of politics at Princeton University and the author of a variety of articles and books. His co-author, Benjamin I. Page, P-A-G-E. Benjamin Page is a professor at Northwestern University outside of Chicago in Evanston, Illinois, and he's likewise very well known and the author of books and articles. two prestigious professors from two prestigious departments of political science in two prestigious American universities. They studied, in order to make sure they had it right, 1,779 policy issues being fought out in governmental bodies. That was their goal. And here is the interesting thing they found, and I'm going to read to you from the abstract of their paper, that's the short summary that begins its appearance in the Perspectives on Politics journal. I want to read it to you so there's no mistake. Analysis indicates that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. By the way, one of those mass-based interest groups is the trade union movement. But so are other movements, associations of retired persons, even the National Rifle Association, unless, of course, the part of it that's a business institute were to be taken into account and separated from the part that claims to be somebody helping gun owners, and so on. Here's the bottom line. Business calls the shots. Business organizations that are mostly run by the biggest businesses amongst us, they're the ones who make things happen. And this is the scientific, documented, empirical research by authors Gillens and Page in the journal Perspectives on Politics, September 2014, that backs it up. The second question that we will have time to deal with today is a real doozy, a big one. The question is, what is fascism? I've been getting more and more of these questions, which I understand because people make it quite clear that they're scared about where the United States is going. And one of the reasons they're scared is that they sense or feel or fear that it's going in a direction of fascism. So let's review so we all understand the term and we can make our decisions as to whether or not or to what extent movement in that direction is visible around the world and including here at home. Fascism is the name of a system in which the government partners very closely with private capitalist enterprises. Usually, and by usually I mean taking the examples of recent fascism in Germany under Hitler, in Italy under Mussolini, in Spain under Franco, in Japan, etc. There have been a number of cases of fascistic governments coming to power. Those are perhaps the most famous, but there are others. The government partners with usually the largest private enterprises, and it subordinates to this partnership the labor movement, often simply dispensing with labor unions or any independent labor organization. Working people either have no organization or are herded into a government-operated union that is subordinated to the needs of capital. It is usually created, fascism is, because big private capitalists are fearful of their ability to continue to hold on to their private enterprises and want the partnership with the government to save them. They are usually anti-democratic people in favor of fascism. They don't want an independent government controlled by the mass of people. That would be a risk for a government to play the role they want, which is partner, supportive partner of private enterprise. It is typically nationalist. That is, the fascists understand that what they are doing is making government serve big business at the expense of working people. So they have to find a way to make this palatable to working people, at least as much as they can. And they usually use a combination of intense nationalism, celebrating the nation, often the ethnic purity of the nation, on the one hand, and using violence and force to repress people who don't want fascism on the other. Germany did that with its idea of the racial purity of Aryans. Italy did it with a kind of celebration of the Italian personality. The Japanese lorded it over other Asians, etc. What is the difference between fascism on the one hand and socialism? Well, basically in socialism, the government doesn't come in and partner with big business. It takes over the big businesses. That's why big business, which is always ready to welcome fascism, every fascism we know of, big business was a major player in bringing it into being. By contrast, big business hates socialism and tries to prevent or stop it every chance it gets. Likewise, socialism is something workers typically support. It comes out of a workers' movement. It tends to be more internationalist than nationalist, and it favors democracy because it sees itself as the representative of the mass of people and therefore is not interested in a government that isn't beholden to the mass of people. Now, socialism can be perverted in directions that make it very different from what it has traditionally been. But no one should mistake it, the replacement of private enterprise by a government that has some roots in the mass of people, with fascism, which is the outright partnering of the government as the subordinate support for what is basically a society governed by private enterprise. We've come to the end of our first half of our program. I would like all of you please to stay with us so we can cross over to the second half, where we're going to deal with a number of major issues that you have brought to our attention and have requested that we spend some time analyzing. Stay with us. We will be right back.
That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update. Once again, I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and I bring you this program every week in the hopes that you will find it interesting, that you will pursue the kinds of ideas and analyses we offer here on our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. One of the biggest issues that a number of you, in fact a growing number of you, have brought to our attention and asked us to comment on has to do with how at least a number of societies are reacting to the resistance, let's call it, that people are putting forward to the policies of austerity that have come forward as the basic response of the business and political elites around the world to the economic crisis that their policies brought to us in the first place. In a sense, we have a capitalist system collapsing in 2008, wreaking havoc across the world, leading governments to take all kinds of steps, borrowing lots of money to try to kickstart the economy up again. When they can begin to see how expensive this plan is of how to get the economy back, not that they've succeeded yet, they haven't, but when they've seen how expensive it is, they've decided that one way to keep the expense of fixing the economy down is to shift the burden off of them, the rich, the corporate leaders, those with the profits, onto the mass of people, giving the mass of people not only the opportunity to suffer from the crisis, but likewise to suffer again by having to pick up the costs of their fix-it program, even though it doesn't work real well. So guess what? Over the last 2 years, 3 years, there's been a growing chorus of resistance. In the first half of the hour, I even documented a few from the last week. Teachers marching through the streets of Seattle. Folks demonstrating across the island of Puerto Rico. The anti-austerity shifts in Portugal. And so on and so on and so on. But the question is, how have governments trying to impose the austerity on the mass of people, how have they reacted to the growing opposition, hardly surprising, of people who don't want the solution to a crisis they didn't bring to be found by a plan that makes them pay the cost? They don't want that, which is hardly a surprise. Well, let's see how governments have reacted. On March 26th of this year, the Spanish government, controlled by a party that is a gung-ho supporter of austerity, and in the face of popular opposition, 80% of Spaniards polled were against the legislation passed by the government there. They passed something called a citizens' security law. What goes into effect on July 1st, very few days from now, police will have the discretionary ability to hand out fines of up to, now get this, $650,000 to unauthorized demonstrators who protest near a transport hub or a nuclear power plant. They will be allowed, the police that is, to issue fines of up to $30,000 for taking pictures of police during protests and so on. Now, this does not take rocket science to understand. This is an attempt by a government whose ideas are rejected by 80% of its citizens, who now regret having voted them into office, by the way. This is an attempt by that government to savagely repress freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of protest. Freedoms guaranteed by countless international conventions that, by the way, Spain, as well as the other countries I'm about to give you as examples, they've signed the documents committing them to freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of protest. What they're doing now is undermining their own signature, going back. And the important thing is not that they are violating their own rules and laws and commitments. That's the least of it. What I want to get across is the economics of it. They provoked a crisis. They've decided to deal with the crisis by austerity. That provokes people to protest. And instead of sitting down and figuring out how to change the policy to deal with such massive protest, their solution is to try to repress the protest. That's not democracy. That's that fascism coming that we talked about in the last half hour. And it's particularly interesting coming in Spain, which had one of the most violent, bitter, fascistic governments for decades under Francisco Franco. It is a very scary proposition to watch that minority of the Spanish people who seem to be hankering after return to the bad old days of Mr. Franco. But I wouldn't be spending this much time on that subject if it were only Spain. Last year and the year before, students in Quebec, Canada, were absolutely heroic in fighting the austerity cuts being imposed on their educations. And as a result, all kinds of repressive legislation came down from the Quebec legislature, particularly the infamous Bill 78, which made pickets and unauthorized gatherings of over 50 people illegal, with fines of over $125,000 for organizations. Protest is a right of the citizens in anything wanting to call itself even just a little bit democratic. Cutting off protest is a very bad omen and sign for where a society is going. Last October, a law was passed in Turkey allowing police to search demonstrators in their homes without warrant. This February, in London, police forced climate protest organizers to hire private security as marshals for a rally so that a free public right of protest could no longer be exercised, but you had to spend a great deal of money in order to have a protest. Wow. Police in Australia gained the power to bar protesters from appearing in public spaces for a year. Other countries did likewise. Mexico's Congress, which is currently going through its procedures, if it's ratified by the states, it will modify their new law, their own constitution, so that, quote, unauthorized gathering would be illegal. Wow. And you can see it creeping here in the United States. In Baltimore, during the recent troubles there over the police shootings of unarmed people, many of those who protested the death of Freddie Gray were held without charges for over 48 hours. That's not what you expect in a society that understands the right to protest, especially when it's as justified as in almost all these cases the protests were. Wow. Wow. What's going on? As a society becomes more and more unequal, driven by an economic system, let's call it what it's called, capitalism, that puts profits first and allows the pursuit of profit basically to trump most other considerations, including those of democracy and so on, we're seeing a society producing the effects, and above all, growing inequality with all that that means, that is also in turn producing its normal effects. Those at the bottom, those hurt the most, revolting, rebelling, rejecting, kicking back. Do they always do it in the best way? No. Any more than the police repression being imposed on them is not done, as we have seen, in the quote-unquote right way. If you provoke fundamental social divisions, you're going to have trouble on your hands, and trouble doesn't obey the rules. That's why we call it trouble. But there are subtle ways that this is happening also, the repression of opposition to a system that is subjecting more and more majorities to discrimination, economic difficulty, unfair burdens, and so on. I'm going to pick one, thanks to one of you who brought it to my attention. It's called the Interstate Voter Cross-Check. Sounds innocuous. It is the brainchild of the Secretary of State of the state of Kansas, a Republican named Chris Kobach, K-O-B-A-C-H. Here's what he's proudly done. He's compiled a list. Apparently it is 7 million voters who he claims may, underscore the word may, be registered in more than one state because that represents a risk that they will vote more than one time, which is illegal, and which would give those people a disproportionate impact on electoral outcomes. It turns out that the vast bulk of the 7 million voters in quite a few states, because he's gotten other states to cooperate, it turns out that the last names of these voters are very disproportionately Hispanic, African American, Asian American, and other kinds of identifiable, more or less identifiable, voters. So it turns out that this isn't really a cross-check, is it? It's much more of an attempt to purge the voter rolls of people likely not going to vote for the Republican austerity programs being pushed in places like Kansas, and indeed many of the other Midwestern states that have moved sharply to the right in terms of who their governments are. This is voter suppression. It's trying to get rid of voting lists of people on the voting eligibility lists who are thought to likely be enemy voters. It's a little bit like what we have done traditionally in the United States, in which we have denied the votes to felons, people who have been convicted of a felony, people who have gone to jail to serve their time, who are now considered under the law to be just like you and me, but we don't let them vote in many parts of the United States. Wow. And who are these people? We know who the majority of felons are. They are Hispanic and African American. Males who have gone through the prison system of the United States at a wildly disproportionate number relative to their role in the population. By making felons unable to vote, you are excluding a particular group of people who, guess what, tend to vote Democratic. Were we to have fairness in our mind, to say to a person convicted of a felony, you've paid your so-called debt to society, you can now vote since you're going to be affected by what is decided in politics like everybody else. If we did that, it would help the Democrats. And that's why we don't do that. The Democrats haven't had the strength to fight it. The Republicans enjoy, as a whole, perpetuating it. And so it sits. This interstate voter cross-check is just another ploy in the same direction. These are underminings of democratic processes. We don't have that much democracy in this country that we can afford to let go of even the smallest bit of it. But cutting out the voting lists, depriving yet more people from an easy way to participate in that little minimum act of at least casting a ballot, is not a direction of our social development that we should applaud. It's one we deplore. It's a sign that those at the top cannot and do not trust the people, and for good reason, given how they are being treated, the people I mean, in our economic system. Keeping an unjust economic system requires getting rid of universal suffrage, the right to vote, and that's what is going on here in the United States with the interstate voter cross-check, and that's the parallel effort to eliminating the right of people to protest alongside their right to vote. These are signs of a society and an economy spinning out of control and moving in the direction of deepening social conflict. The final issue for today, big issue, is the crisis of public education. And here I want to just bring together a number of strains of thought that you all have brought to my attention in various ways, leading me to do a variety of kinds of research, and I want to bring you the fruits of that. The first has to do with the point and purpose of public education. Let's really be clear before we see what's happening. Public education, which had to be established in the United States, as in other countries, by strenuous political efforts of masses of working people who wanted an education. And they wanted it because that was the way up out of poverty and ignorance for people. It was a way for parents to help their children do better than they did. Public education was an equalizer. Before public education, people who didn't have money got no education at all. Education was a privilege to be gotten by the money you had. Didn't have money, you wouldn't get an education. And guess what? If you didn't have money and you didn't get an education, you'd probably never be anything other than poor. It was a way of keeping poor people poor, and poor people knew it. That's why they fought hard to get public education. Number two, public education is a much cheaper and more efficient way to educate people than private education. That's one of the reasons why private education is so much more expensive. Public education is the way to go if you really have a commitment to your people. A public school system that is centrally built and functioned and organized and monitored can be the best way to go. That's why public education has been adopted in virtually every country on the face of the earth as the way to bring education to the mass of people. They don't have the money to pay the private cost of education. In many countries, they've outlawed private education precisely because it's unfair to the mass of people. Third, public education, by educating the mass of people, makes a society and an economy more competitive in a world economy. The single most important thing for the future of the American economy is the quality and the training of our young people, the new workforce. If we sacrifice that, we are shooting ourselves in the foot for the future. The only reason American business is now supporting cuts in public education for Americans is because they've moved to other parts of the world and they expect to be able to hire well-educated people at lower salaries and prices in China, in India, in Brazil than they had to pay here. So they don't care the way they once did to support public education. They had to be dragged kicking and screaming to do it back in the 19th century, but they began to understand their benefits and so supported it in the 20th. But now that they've moved and they're looking to hire people elsewhere, their interest in American public higher education is flagging. And that's one of the losses of supports that shows up in what? In what I'm about to tell you. Over the last few years, one recent study showed, Americans are not going to college the way they once did. In a story in the Bloomberg Financial News Service of May 14th, Janet Lauren writes, "Millennials are ditching college and heading back to the workplace." And she shows in her article very nicely that four-year for-profit schools and two-year public schools, what we mostly call community colleges, have, over the last two or three years, lost enrollment, big time, 4 or 5% in a couple of years. That's a major drop. Those are people who are at the low end of the income scale. People who don't come from rich families are the ones who go to four-year for-profit schools or to two-year community colleges. And they're not going anymore. They're dropping out of that plan. They're simply going to work or dropping out and going back to work. And even in the private four-year colleges and the public, the nonprofits we call them, and the public higher education, enrollments are steady. But if the enrollment is steady while your population goes up, you're not educating people the way you did before. So we are driving people out of higher education, and that is not smart. Second, another Bloomberg report, May 18th. Scholarships are going less and less to needy people and more to people who have the money. Merit is being used. You give it to the people who have merit. What does that mean? That means young people whose parents were rich enough to hire tutors, to send them to a private school, to get them all kinds of help to take the necessary exams. Giving scholarships on merit is rewarding the people who have the money and the resources, and that's why we always had scholarships based on need. The need-based scholarships are being cut, merit-based scholarships are rising. And then in the New York Times, May 19th, David Leonhardt explains the shift in public higher education from taking in-state schools to students, and taking out-of-state students. Let me explain. Most state universities, and all 50 states have them, were meant to help people with limited amounts of money in the state which set up the university. So Nebraska has a university catering to Nebraskans, and New Jersey has Rutgers that caters to New Jersey, and so on. And the way to make that work was to say, we're going to help the people in our state to afford a college education for their kids. So in-state tuition, that is the tuition for people in the state of that university, was made low. What have public universities done? Those that have been cut because the state legislatures don't give them as much money, those who have been hurt because the federal government has cut back on monetary support for public universities, those that have been hurt have reacted in two ways. They've jacked up the prices, but when that wasn't enough, and by the way, when you jack up the prices of college education, you force millions of Americans to borrow money to go to school. And we all know what that means and what a burden that has been as we now graduate the first classes from our universities to enter the workforce at a time of poor job opportunities, poor income opportunities, and loaded up with unprecedented debt. That doesn't go on in Europe. We don't do that there, do we? But we do it here, and that ought to make you wonder. Well, David Leonhardt's article in the New York Times demonstrates what other public universities have done is stop taking in-state students whose tuitions are low and more taking out-of-state students who pay a much higher rate for the same education in the same university. That's how they're solving their problem. So more and more of the positions in state higher education are going to the people with the money, and fewer for the people with the need. We are undercutting higher education. We are making it a privilege for the people who already have, and making it harder and harder for the people who don't. And the bottom line is furthering the divide in our society, deepening the injustices that undermine a democratic society, or at least one trying to move in that direction. And we're undercutting the ability of the United States to compete. We're giving more reason for companies who will soon be saying to us, well, you don't have enough educated people. They're not educated well enough. We're going elsewhere, hoping that we will not realize that it's because they went elsewhere earlier that they undercut the support for higher education. We've come to the end of our program. I want, please, your attention as I go through some of the folks and some of the things we ask you to do. The folks who help us first. Truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Please check out the valuable work that they do, truthout.org. Please also visit our websites. And when you do, at rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info, please use them to communicate to us your thoughts, your preferences, what you would like this program to do, your questions you would like us to answer. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Make use of what you find on the website and what you get in this program. Share it with people who might like to learn about it as well. And please sign up for our free newsletter. It is a way for you to keep up with what we do, and we send it to you, and of course, it is available at no charge. Finally, I am making several trips, speaking trips, this fall, and I would like that to be announced here so that those of you who might be interested in organizing a meeting or a conference or an evening for me to present the kind of work that I do on the program, if you're in any of the following areas, do get in touch with us through the websites. Kansas City, likely September. Houston, likely November. Tampa, Florida area, likely November. Kansas City, Toronto in the fall. So these are areas, and I should add Fresno, California as well, in October. These are areas that I will be at, and I am looking for opportunities to interact with more of you as we spread the word about an economic system that isn't working for most of us and that needs fundamental change. Thank you very much, and I look forward to speaking with you again. Next.
Gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.